aspect to it that is unique. That often we talk about various mitzvot and trying to understand what their tam is and how that may impact our interpretation of the mitzvah and of details of the mitzvah. Here, there is a situation that really isn't a category of its own, that we read about the aftermath of the quarrel of the wrestling match between Yaakov and the Malach, and the Tzaras Shel Esav, and Yaakov is injured in his sciatic nerve. And in that context, so the Torah tells us here in Parak Lamed Beis, Pasuk Lamed Gimel, Al Kain Lo Yochlu Bnei Yisrael Eskid Hadasha Asher Al Kaf Hayarech Ad Hayom Hazeh Ki Naga B'Chaf Yarech Yaakov B'Gid Hadasha. So here you have an unusual kind of thing, that you have a mitzvah that is embedded within the narrative of the Torah, within the story, and the mitzvah is explicitly associated with the story, that here we're told that we are not allowed to eat the Gid Hanasha because of what happened to Yaakov. And the relationship is actually even more interesting, because if you had a chance to see the Rambam in the Parash Mishnayos at the end of the 7th Parak of Chulin, so he takes pains to emphasize that we should not get the impression that this constitutes the Tzivoy, or that this is when the Tzivoy happened. That the reason we nowadays do not eat, the halachic reason, meaning the binding nature of why we do not eat the Gid Hanasha Bezman Hazeh, emphasizes the Rambam, is because at Maimar Har Sinai, when we received the Torah, so Moshe commanded us in all the mitzvahs of the Torah, and we are forbidden to eat the Gid Hanasha because of that. And you shouldn't get the impression that it's a mitzvah from the time of Yaakov, as the Pasuk seems to suggest. So there's a reference to this idea in the Gemara as well. If you look in the Gemara in the beginning of Gid Hanasha, so there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of points of dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim about certain details of how the Gid Hanasha applies. And it seems that Rabbi Yehuda is actually tied in very closely to the story, and that he derives details of the dinim of Gid Hanasha as far as what matches most closely Yaakov, and also as far as the history of it happening in that context at that time. And the Chachamim disagree. And what emerges is that's a discussion really about the fact that the Pasuk places it in this context here in Vayishlach. And the Chachamim are explaining that no, that doesn't mean that the mitzvah was from then. It's just placed in there to give it context. So that itself is a fascinating idea. First of all, the Rambam taking pains to emphasize that even though we have other cases where we also have mitzvos that are associated with narratives, maybe a little bit less tightly in the text, but as we note, so for example, the Bris Milah, which is associated with Avraham Avinu, but we shouldn't think that our tzivoy comes from there. Everything comes from Moshe Rabbeinu when he gave us the Torah at Har Sinai. And the Meshech Chachma and Parshas Vezo Sabracha has a long piece there where he talks about the unique aspect of Nevuas Moshe, and he cites this Rambam to make the point that when we listen to a Navi, so the Navi is supposed to establish himself with a siman. So theoretically, you might have thought that a Navi could establish himself in a way that would allow him to contradict the Nevuah of Moshe in the sense of the giving of the Torah. So he emphasizes why that can't be true. And he compares it to, he says, the nature of revelation is far more significant than any other prophecy anyone else could have. And he gives an example, he gives a comparison. It's like, let's say you saw something with your own eyes, and then two Edim come and tell you the opposite. So even though there's a general credibility to the two Edim, but in this case, if they're contradicting what you saw yourself, so you'll know that you're going to believe what you saw yourself. So the Nevuah of Moshe Rabbeinu is in a different category than any other Nevuah. So even if someone would establish himself as a Navi and would come to contradict Moshe Rabbeinu, we wouldn't accept that contradiction. So in that context, he cites this Rambam and he emphasizes why it's so important that the mitzvot that we practice come through Moshe Rabbeinu specifically, and that the mitzvot of the Torah are through that avenue. So even Gehanasha, with its statement here in the Torah in Parshas Vayishlach, is not coming from Yaakov or his family, is coming from the Sivui of Moshe. But what that does do is it calls attention all the more so to the fact that there is clearly a message being conveyed in the citing of this mitzvah here, that we should understand that indeed there is this strong relationship, that the prohibition of the Gehanasha goes back to the message of the interaction with Yaakov and the Malach. So many understand that this is set up as some kind of a zikaron, as some kind of a reminder. So, for example, it's how the Sefer Achinuch understands it, that this is here to remind us that God does not forget us in Gullus, and that God is with us. And so, therefore, this reminds us of that interaction and reminds us of the message behind that interaction. The Rashbam has a different spin, that it's there to remind us both of miracles and also of the heroism of Yaakov. The Ralbag has an interesting spin on it, where he understands that it's to remind us and to publicize the fact that you see the very powerful prophetic reality that Yaakov experienced, because here he fights with an angel, and he ends up with an actual physical injury. You see just how real it was. You see just how genuine was his connection with the prophetic experience and with the spiritual experience. And we want to publicize that. So there are a number of interpretations along these lines that this is something that's meant for publicity or something that's meant for a zikaron. So the problem is, it's a little bit difficult to understand how that fits. Because normally, if we want to remember something, we would take a very different approach. And this is particularly relevant to us right now as we're approaching Hanukkah. So if you want to compare this to Hanukkah, so we know that Hanukkah is very much about remembering Nisan, that's the theme, and being Mefarsim the Nes. So all of that is an idea that we can very much relate to as we anticipate Hanukkah. But the whole point is that we do something, that we light candles and we look at the candles, and that reminds us. But to have a prohibition of something we don't do and say that that's going to serve as a reminder, it's a little bit hard to understand. How can we remember something by not seeing it? And especially, practically speaking, for us nowadays, for most observant Jews, so the impact of the prohibition of the Gehanasha is going to mean that you're just never going to come in contact your whole life with the Gehanasha. So the idea that that's going to remind you of something is difficult. Maybe you could say, if we assumed that we were talking specifically to butchers, so then we could say, all right, so then the act of removing the Gehanasha perhaps is something that would remind us, but certainly from a consumer perspective, the impact of this prohibition is that we never see a Gehanasha. So how is it supposed to remind us of anything? It really seems the complete opposite of what we normally do when we want to remember something. And especially in contrast to the impending celebration of Hanukkah, it's very striking. How could we see this as a reminder? So Rav Moshe Feinstein addresses this question a little bit in the Sefer Darash Moshe. His suggestion is that maybe, yes, we want to show that we're able to overcome these challenges, but it's even better not to encounter them in the first place, even better to avoid nisyonos and challenges. So that's one approach. There are other approaches that we should first note that don't see the Gehanasha as a reminder so much, but maybe have a different focus. And so, for example, there are some who understand that there is a punishment here to the Jewish people, that they are deprived of this good food, that there's something that is appealing of the Gehanasha. That's the way the Rush expresses it, and Tosfos Rush is this idea, and also the Chizkuni, that the Jews and the Bnei Yaakov, the Bnei Yisrael, are deprived of the Gehanasha because of something that they did wrong. It's interesting that the Rush has this language of Meichel Tov, because it sounds like from the Gemara that it actually doesn't have any taste at all, that it's a chiddush, that it could even be an iser achila related to the git hanasha because it's tasteless as the git. But it could be that he's talking about the other meat that's interwoven with the git that we miss out on because we have to remove the git. But okay, that's the language that he has, that we lose out on a meichel tov. So what was the avera? What was the crime that the children of Yaakov had to pay a price for? So some point to a lack of levaya, to a lack of escorting, that we know that we have a mitzvah of hachnasas orchim that we read about in Parshas Vayera. And there is a component to that that we normally associate specifically with that mitzvah, that after the guests are finished, so we're supposed to escort them out. And the Torah describes Avram doing that. So we're familiar with that. The Rambam emphasizes in Mishneh Torah, it's a separate institution, it's a separate chesed, an obligation of itself. It's a whole discussion why nowadays we don't find people so concerned about this and so careful about this. But it's also important to emphasize that we find Levaya separate and distinct from Hachnasas Orchim, that it's not only that when you have a guest over that you should escort him out, but also anybody who might be vulnerable, who might be lost, we have an obligation to accompany them and to not leave them alone. So, for example, some of the Rishonim point to the Pasuk in Parshas Shoftim as the marker for Levaya when the Egla Rufa involves the declaration that Yadeinu lo shafchu, that we didn't kill this person who ended up dead, and Chazal explained that no one thought that they actually killed him, but that maybe they were neglectful, and that the notion that you have to be there to help somebody, especially if they're dislocated, and they might not know the area, so you can't let them wander alone, so you have to escort them. And here in this context, we're told by Yavasa Yaakov Levado that Yaakov was left alone, so why did his family let him be in a vulnerable, exposed state? So there's something they did wrong. So that's what the Chizkuni and the Rush point to. And they say that, therefore, in order to make sure that we pay the price, that we should abstain from eating the Git Hanasha. And it's interesting that Sefer Chassidim writes that this language of Alkein Lo Yochlu V'nei Yisrael, that the sons of Yaakov, who are the ones then who are being identified here as neglectful, that they took a neder amongst themselves that they weren't going to eat the Git Hanasha. And that seems to anticipate our current prohibition of eating the Git Hanasha. So that's another take on it that is a little bit easier to relate to as far as the question that we asked before, because if you say that it's not necessarily a reminder, but it's something that we lose out on, okay, so then we lose out on it, then that's the message. There are others who see it as representing something negative, and therefore, perhaps we're just supposed to stay away from it because it's bad. So the whole phrase, git hanasha, there is extensive literature as to what the word really means, what's the origin of the word, a lot of different theories. Nasha could also mean pushed out of its place, is one kind of interpretation. And the Orach Chaim quotes from the Zohar that the idea is that the Gid was pushed out of the place of holiness, of Makor HaKadusha, and therefore it was subject to the influences of Tumah. And therefore, this is a way of saying that we should stay away from that which is Tameh. If you look at Rashi in Chumash, he writes that Nashim Komo, it was pushed out of its place, and that's how the Orach Chaim expands on it, that it was exposed to Tumah, and that's the message that we should stay away from Tumah, the way it is in the Zohar, that we should stay away from the influence of Rishayim, and that's what this interaction of Yaakov and the Malach is supposed to convey to us, that there is a danger there that we should remove ourselves from. The Nitziv, in his commentary, has a little bit of a different spin on it. He says that the Git is very rigid, and the person shouldn't be rigid. You have to figure out exactly why Yaakov was identified as being suspect of the too much rigidity, but discusses that a little bit, but he suggests that that's the message, that we have to be separated from that type of a symbol, and to recognize that we have to be more flexible, and that we have to not be so rigid. So those interpretations also don't necessarily have the same problem of seeing the Git Hanasha as a memorial and then not looking at it at all, the question that we started off with. But could be maybe what fits best, perhaps, is the idea of the Sforno. That the Sforno has a comment that because of what happens here, Al-Kain, that Al-Kain signifies that here you have Yaakov who was interacting with the Malach and he was injured in this way, in that place. So as a consequence of that, we should see it as nothing. That essentially we want the inspiring message here to be that we are able to prevail and to overcome. So even if Yaakov was injured here, okay, so then we don't care about that. It's kilu if somebody says, you know, he steps on your toe, and then he apologizes, and you say, it's okay, I have 9 more. Right? Okay, you stepped on that toe, I don't care about that toe, it doesn't matter, I'm able to function without it. So kilu, that's the same point here, that we say, okay, so this is where Yaakov was injured, we don't need to get a nasha, we can relate to life without it. And that may explain, it's actually a machlokus in the Gemara, a little bit of a debate back and forth about the nature of the prohibition of the eating of the Gidhanasha. So is it eating specifically, or is it actually a prohibition of Hana? We're not allowed to benefit at all from the Gidhanasha. So that's a discussion. The second parak of Psachim is a whole back and forth about what Yisuri Achila are in general. So if one were to take the position that the Gid Hanasha is an Isser Hana, so then it fits even better, that basically the nature of the Isser is that we should not be misyaches to the Gid Hanasha at all. That, okay, so this was injured in Yaakov's body, so we don't need it. We can go along without it. We don't need to eat it. We don't need to be nana from it at all. It's not something that's going to get in our way. So that's another possibility. But in any event, we see this whole range of understandings that are associated with the Gid Hanasha, and there are multiple messages that emerge. Rav Nevinsal has a drash about this in his Sichos, where he emphasizes that Nasha also comes to the language of forgetting, that this is something that comes to make us forget, like we find when the name Menashe is given. Yosef gives his son the name Menashe, and he says, Kinashani Hashem, and then God helped me to forget all my problems. So that the representation here also, and the connection with this whole interaction with the Malach of Esav, is to say that this represents what tries to make us forget, what tries to distract us and all of the tsaros of the world, which can impose on our attention and can distract us from what's really important. So we have to prevail over that. And then to avoid the Gid Hanasha is a way of saying that, again, we're not going to let this get in our way. We're not going to let this interfere. And this is also a Hanukkah theme that we recite in Al Hanisim, that when we talk about what the Yevanim tried to do to us, so it's a focus on the spiritual impact. We know that we say that in Hanukkah we don't have an obligation of a Suda like we do on Purim, because Purim was about physical threat, so we celebrated physically with a meal, while Hanukkah was about spiritual threats. So the language that we find is that the Yevanim tried the Hashkicham Teresecha, to make us forget, to make us not remember the Torah. It happens to be a specific prohibition in the Torah that we're not allowed to forget our learning. It's an interesting question what that means. Sounds like from the Gemara that it means that we will intentionally try to set it aside. I mean, halavai, we could just choose to remember everything that we learn. We know it's much harder. So say there's a prohibition to forget, you have to figure out exactly what that means. Rav Moshe Feinstein has a tshuva where he says that the obligation of Talmud Torah in terms of time commitment, so it says if you've accomplished everything you need to accomplish, then you can devote some time to other things. What does it mean, everything you need to accomplish? It means you have to learn Kol HaTorah Kula, and you have to have chazered enough that you're not going to forget, because the prohibition of forgetting the Torah, so this is, that must mean that you have to learn it all the first time, and that you have to have it so solid that you're not going to forget. So basically it's a application that seems to refer only to him personally, but the rest of us can strive. But that's how he understood this prohibition of forgetting the Torah. So we find that there is this specific emphasis that we shouldn't forget the Torah, that we should remember, and that there are forces that seek to make us forget. Lahashkicham Torasach, and that's what the Yavanim wanted to do, and that's what Esav wanted to do, and his Malach wanted to do, that they wanted to get in our way and to stop the whole Masorah, to stop the whole memory of the Torah from passing on into the future. He notes in that context, a different part of the year, we know on Tisha B'Av, so we talk about the Gemara is in Gittin about the Chorban, and the Gemara talks about the whole story about Kamsa and Bar Kamsa and the effort to frame the Jewish people by sending an animal on behalf of the Kesar that had a mum that was secretly placed there, and the Jews didn't know what to do. And that the Gemara says that as Zachariah ben Avkulas, so he wouldn't allow them to do anything out of the ordinary. He wouldn't allow them to kill the messenger, because he said, Yomru matal mum bekachim yihareg, that people will say that somebody who imposes a mum on kachim should be killed for it, and that's not really the din. And they wouldn't bring it either, because they thought maybe that would be a good move to keep the authorities from getting angry. And he said, no, Yomru bali mum kraven agave mizbech, people will think that this is what the din is, that we would bring a balmum in the mizbech, so we can't do it. So it seems, to go back to the Netziv, it seems like a very rigid position, especially in the face of great sakana. So Rav Nevensal explained that the emphasis there is not just a violation of halacha, but he kept saying, yomru this, yomru that, that people will say that this is the din. In other words, that there will be a whole misunderstanding of what the halacha actually is, and it'll be transmitted that way, that he was worried about the forgetting of the Torah, and that this is something that we have to work very hard to prevent. We have to work very hard to make sure that we are on top of, and that we don't let that happen. So then, as he notes, you might say, okay, so it sounds like that's a good concern, but the Gemara actually says that he made a mistake, and that is because of his unwillingness to be more bold. The Gemara calls Anvastanuso, his modesty, that there was a terrible disaster and that the Chorban happened, that Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So he says, yeah, so that's because he saw long term it wasn't such a good calculation, because the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. So then that's going to have a much greater impact on the Torah's ability to be remembered and to stay in people's minds than all of these other more localized concerns that Reb Zecharia had. So it's all about the same point, is that there's this tremendous emphasis on making sure that the Torah is remembered and keeping that going even when there are other forces coming at us and there are other things that get in the way. So this is itself a very important message for us, Bizman Hazah, that certainly we have all kinds of distractions. We have all kinds of things getting in our way. Sometimes they are very sad and harmful distractions of all kinds of challenges in life that make it very hard for us to focus and to keep our attention on the content of the learning. Sometimes they are good things that take us away because they're so attractive and they're so appealing, but that also has the result of making us forget. And they can come from any direction. I think one point that's important to appreciate is that nowadays we have so much technology, and technology, we always talk about the pluses and the minuses and the ups and downs, but what about specifically even in the area of Torah? So we have access to so many Torah sources because of technology, and so we often have the mindset that that part, okay, that's a unmitigated good. That's something which, out of all the questions of the pluses and minuses of technology, so the access to all the Torah, that's got to be a good. But, and it is, it's a tremendous thing, it's a wonderful thing, but it can sometimes also take away from our ability to remember the Torah, because first of all, we're not always putting in the same amelus that we were in the past, we're not necessarily always working as hard. It's an interesting discussion that those who suggest that studies are indicating that people who write down with a pen actually have better recall than people who record with a computer, that maybe the greater effort and attention that has to come to writing with a pen on paper is actually more effective towards recall. There is that amelus component, but also, even more so, we have to be careful that we shouldn't get in the mindset that we don't need to remember anything or to even learn things in the first place, because we know that at a push of a button, everything is available to us and we can find it right away. So sometimes we get into the mindset, we don't say this out loud, but we get into the kind of thinking that, okay, we don't really even need to work on remembering, we don't even need to learn in the first place, because it's always there for us with the technology, and that's going to replace that whole effort. And that would be a chaval if that's the way we think, that we are very blessed to have the technology that we have and to have the ability to find Makara so quickly and to be able to find more than we would have found and to find it quicker. So what that should mean is that we should be able to go much further. We should be able to take all the technology and propel ourselves with great energy towards greater accomplishments in learning. So if we take all the technology and we use it to help us accomplish more than we could have, that's a phenomenal thing. If the technology means that we accomplish the same in less time and then we're not doing as much as we could be, so then that is an unfortunate effect, and that's something that we very much have to be on the guard for. And it's a whole different angle of the kind of things that can perhaps sometimes make us forget, and that's something we have to be on guard for. Max, you have a question? We're very pro-technology. Like I said, Yahyu Torah is a tremendous blessing. But the point is, so we use Yahyu Torah to advance our learning and to accomplish so much more, and not to accomplish, it's funny you said, because sometimes I don't get a chance to write down something and I rely on the fact that it's recorded on Yahyu Torah, and it's a good reminder that, yes, it's a tremendous bracha that it's recorded, so we should use that to grow more. We should use that to be able to accomplish much more and not to accomplish less because we have outsourced all of our need to remember, and even more so our need to learn in the first place, on the technology. Okay, so that's okay. Singularity. The singularity. He talks about the singularity. Yeah. Thinks we're going to merge with the machines.
Essentially, yeah.
Yeah, the singularity. Yeah, absolutely. Shkoyach, yeah, very much so.
He never really responded to it, and it wasn't a very good conversation, because he signed up to barely speak English, and this guy was obviously an American guy, so it was so weird.
They needed the technology to translate.
Yes.
But, okay, so just to mention one more point, and then we'll wrap up. So, just after this, so the Pasuk will just mention this one more idea, that the Pasuk talks about that when he actually does meet with Esav, so if to skip ahead to Lamed Gimel Dalet, just towards the end here, Vayaretz Esav Lakroso, Vechapkehu, Vayipol al Tavarav, Vishakehu, Vayivku. So Vishakehu is printed in the Torah with dots on top of it. And that's actually a very fascinating concept, the whole idea of dots. So we actually have a tradition that dots are an important method of understanding the Torah, that this is some type of a Nidosh Torah Nidreshes Behem, that it tells us something about the content. And sometimes we find that it has halachic ramifications, and sometimes it has narrative applications. So here it seems like it has narrative applications. And we see the Rashi writes, Nokod Olav, there are dots on top of it. And so v'yesh cholkin b'davar hazeh b'braisa d'sifrei v'yesh shadarshu nekuda zu lomar shlo nashku b'chol libo. So some say that this means that it was not sincere. He wasn't kissing him really with actual feeling. And Amr Shimon bar Yochai halacha hi b'yadua she'esav son of Yaakov. El shenich merachamav v'osa shah v'nashku b'chol libo. So kind of two interpretations that mean to show that it was lacking, or that it actually was sincere, despite the fact that there was such animosity between them. So that's an interesting discussion, what exactly to do with that, and the whole aspect of the impact of dots and things like that, but also this phrasing, which we'll just want to make a comment about. But Zach, you have a question? Yeah, so it's a good question. It's a much longer topic, but for now, just to say a little bit about it, so it's important to appreciate that so very often this phrase in Rashi is taken to mean that there is the eternal, unchangeable, immutable reality of anti-Semitism, that Halacha b'yadua, Esav sonei es Yaakov, and that sometimes becomes a little bit of a self-perpetuating perception of reality. And my friend Rabbi Yitzchak Adlerstein once wrote in Cross Currents that it's important to appreciate that that's not necessarily the only interpretation. He writes that he searched, he says, before the 19th century, he says, he couldn't find anywhere that interpreted Esav as a nation of Esav, and then anything other than the individual Esav. And that goes a little bit to Zach's question, which we'll have to expand on a different time. But in terms of the history between Yaakov and Esau, personally, the individuals, so we can understand why there's a difficult feeling between them. So the idea that it should be expanded to everyone, who's all the whole non-Jewish world, is a big stretch and can be a harmful stretch. It's true we have to also understand the phrase halacha b'yadua. He also points out that not all the texts have that word halacha b'yadua. Some have it halo b'yadua. So whether this is really an appropriate extension to say that it refers to the nation, it refers to some kind of immutable reality of anti-Semitism, that can sometimes have its own effect, and that can sometimes blind us to what really might be a different kind of attitude. So we have to be very careful and to know exactly how to apply that and how to interpret the reality around us, both Lakula and Lachum. Rabbi Yashiv has a comment here where he's talking about Esav specifically and saying that Esav's sinah is greater than others. We see that Rivka advised Yaakov to run to Lavan, even though Lavan's got his own problems. So that's to emphasize that Esav is particularly born of animosity to Yaakov, and that Yaakov, they were connected in a way that it was kind of a zero-sum game. So whatever Yaakov would benefit, Esav felt he was losing, and vice versa. So therefore, he had that kind of a self-interest, negative attitude towards him, and that also kind of intensified things. Just a note that the pasuk ends also vayivku, they cried, and the Nitziv comments over there that they both cried because for a minute Yaakov did appreciate for Esav, he did have an appreciation for Esav, and also for the potential of the future here to extend it to future generations, that when there can be a reconciliation, that there is that aspect to cry and to appreciate also. So a lot to unpack here and a lot to think about. As we go into the Shabbos, we know that this parsha is considered very significant overall as far as understanding the relationship that the Jew has to all of the challenges that he may face in the world, whether they are spiritual challenges or physical challenges or any type in between. So we should all merit that our careful attention to this parsha and study the parsha should keep us prepared and keep us in a place where we are best able to persevere and to maintain our identity and to thrive despite everything that the world tends to throw at us. I wish you all a wonderful Shabbos. Should be only good things. I look forward to seeing you on Sunday, and we'll be in touch with details.